Hey, everybody. You're listening to Into the Dark. We have a great show for you today, but before we get to the witchcrafty business, just a quick reminder that if you want to be the light of our lives and support the radio station that allows for witchcrafty radio to be part of your life every other week, go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. I'll see you sexy kids on the other end of the theme music. Stay tuned for more Into the Dark.
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always
the often erotic word of the witch.
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Into the Dark. It is a sex thing deep down, of course. On the night of the Witch's Sabbath, it's the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We have a big show for you today. We're going to play an interview I did with Callum Hutchings, who has been studying the occult practices of Thailand, and they get pretty, pretty dark. And it's frankly awesome. I mean, you know, bits of it are scary, but it's mostly cool to talk about, at least. And we'll also be answering a listener question about the St. Louis Arch, and also just, hey guys, nice to say hello. It's a hot, hot summer day. So let's get right into the business, because it is hot, and the sooner I leave, the sooner I can be in air conditioning and drinking whatever witches drink to stay cool. It'd be like witches brew, but something colder, I don't know. I mean, IPAs. Anyway, so let us get to that listener question that was sent to me via Twitter. And the thing about this is, like, remember, you can send questions to our research department through our email address at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. That's intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. But you can also send them in via Twitter if you just tweet at me. And that's at Cooper Wilhelm, because that is my name. I'm Cooper Wilhelm. Hi, how are you? Hello. So just go to at Cooper Wilhelm, Cooper like the tire, Wilhelm like the Kaiser, and submit your questions, and you'll get them answered, including today's question. Dear Into the Dark, what's the deal with the St. Louis Arch? Is there anything occult going on there with that? And I'm really glad somebody asked this question. So, like, St. Louis Arch, huge monument in St. Louis, Missouri. Some quick stats. It's 630 feet high. It is the world's tallest arch, the tallest man-made monument in the Western Hemisphere, and Missouri's tallest accessible building. I think it's also the most stainless steel used in a single monument. So it's a big thing. And the thing is, like, from its inception, it has been mired in suspicion and controversy. Like, one of the early arguments against making this arch was that there was a suggestion that it was secretly a fascist image, because apparently at the time, Italian fascist leader Mussolini was super into arches. And so the argument had been made, like, yes, it's an arch, but not that kind of arch. Mussolini likes one kind of arch. This is a different kind of arch. I don't want to get into arch specifics. It's not... It's kind of boring. It's math. It's a lot of math. I'm not super into math. And, like, the thing is, like, even, like, once it got approved and it got designed, like, there were sort of, like, weird touches of creepiness about it. Because, like, it was dedicated by then Vice President Hubert Humphrey. When he dedicated, he said, frankly, a number of, like, I would think creepy things. Because he calls it, like, you know, a soaring curve in the sky that links the rich heritage of yesterday with the richer future of tomorrow. Which, I mean, you know, that's sort of generic, like, optimism, manifest destiny, etc. But he also said that it brought a new sense of urgency to wipe out every slum. Whatever is shoddy, whatever is ugly, whatever is waste, whatever is false will be measured and condemned. See, that sounds scary to me, because that sounds like he actually has plans for something much more dark and scary. And so, like, the thing is, like, I looked into, like, is there something occult going on? Are there theories as to what is taking place? And the thing is, like, there's a lot of stuff there that, you know, sort of like stuff you would expect to find when people ask questions like, is this a cult, is this not? And like, the big argument is that, like, this might be Masonic imagery, that the arch is a big part of the Freemasons. And like, I can link to, there's an article somebody did where they basically worked out a lot of the mathematics of the St. Louis Arch and how they relate to Masonic practices of astrology. And I can link to that. You can read that on your own time. I'm not going to talk about it because I found it, like, here's the thing, like, I'm a huge nerd. I read about esoteric practices from 400 years ago. Like, this is like, I'm really into, like, nerding out on details and specifics. And even this was sort of like too much for me to deal with, because it was just a lot of like sine, cosine. It was a lot of trigonometry, and I checked out, and I'm sorry. I'm not strong. The flesh is weak. But that's not all of it. That's the thing. So, like, there was that, sure. But the thing is, it was, so the St. Louis Arch was designed by a man named Eero Saarinen. And the thing is, Eero Saarinen is a man about which a lot of sort of rumors are spreading, because apparently he worked for the OSS during the war, the OSS being the precursor to the CIA. And it's been suggested that he might have designed weapons, he might have designed full-scale models, maybe he wrote a manual for the disassembly of bombs. Like, what he was doing is not potentially clear, or at least there has been some suggestion that we should obfuscate the clarity of that. But, like, there's also been the suggestion that people who worked on the atomic bomb also worked in the St. Louis Arch, and that they were building some sort of secret machine. And so, the sort of, there are a number of theories around what is this machine? What is the St. Louis Arch? What is it there to do? And the sort of one of the big prevailing theories is that the arch, because it is a series essentially of metal triangles going up into an arch, is that it is some manner of weather control device. The basic premise is that the shape of this arch, when it is powered at night, when no one is inside of it. Because the thing is, like, you know, tour groups go up the height of the arch inside of the arch. But at night, when there are no tour groups, supposedly there are organizations within the government who turn on this arch, and negative and positively charged ions travel up the height of the arch to its very tippity top. And through this, dispel storms. And the people who support this thesis will claim that if you look at the sort of really nasty weather patterns of the Midwest, you know, tornadoes, big thunderstorms, etc., they have a tendency to move towards St. Louis, split when they get to St. Louis, and go around the city and then rejoin on the other side. And the claim is that it is the St. Louis Arch that is causing them to spread and disperse. It's an interesting thought, certainly. And the thing is, like, you know, we talk a lot on this show about witchcraft. And the thing is, like, witchcraft, I feel like, is very spiritual. But there's a side of me that I don't get into very much. It's very interesting, like, things like conspiracy theories, government conspiracy, things like that. And that's just, like, a hobby of mine. And the thing is, like, when I hear about this sort of, like, this idea that the St. Louis Arch is some sort of weather control device, that it is some sort of nefarious or potentially even benevolent but secret government plot, like, that seems very sort of par for the course for most sort of, like, conspiracy theories about things. Like, they did, like, there's Masonic imagery in it thrown in. Like, that's also very kind of, like, vanilla as conspiracy theories go, because it's like, oh my god, people are secretly Freemasons and they're sending Masonic signals to each other. Oh my god. Like, that's the second you get into, like, American conspiracy theories, like, the Freemasons show up all the time, and it's kind of boring. I mean, sometimes. Sometimes it's really cool, because, like, supposedly Freemasons designed the Washington, D.C. street layout so that there would be a giant pentagram whose major point is at the White House, filling the president full of occult powers. You know, like, that stuff is kind of fun. But I found another conspiracy theory, one that is darker, one that is more extreme and more intense. And these are mostly, this is mostly getting propagated by one YouTube account known as Amerishima 2012. And the thing is, like, Amerishima has a lot of videos about the St. Louis Arch. He also has a lot of videos asking you to check out his band, which is basically kind of like anime pop punk. Like, it sounds sort of like the beginning of the theme song of like an anime show. But he makes this argument that the St. Louis Arch and current events in the general area of St. Louis are more than they appear. So I'm going to play you a little bit of one of his videos just to give you a sense of like what this fella is saying.
Hope you like this one. I want to thank Dean Lewis very much. This is one of the best finds ever, as far as I'm concerned, for telling me about this. And I also want to thank Tina Rex for also finding this and making sure that I saw it. This was on the Colbert Report sometime last week. He was talking about Ferguson, and this is what he says.
I thought they were supposed to leave ages ago through that Stargate they built.
This is as close of an admission that you're going to get from anybody that this thing that thing's a Stargate, and they're all over the world. They do exist. Stonehenge is one. Easter Island is one. They're all over the place. It's what they used to communicate with the fallen angels with. So, where would he get an idea like that? Watching my videos? Well, then he trolls better start trolling him, because now apparently he's taking my material and running with it. And it's not my material. It's not like I came up with this stuff. I'm just saying, I have been making videos about this, so I guess Stephen Colbert just, it's so stupid, he just decided to make a joke outright on his own huge TV show? No. You know why? Because it's truth. It's what it is. And this whole hands up, don't shoot thing, look, Megyn Kelly, Fox News, the AP, got the Blaze even on here. Oh, you know what? Turned out that it's a lie. The whole thing is a lie, but let's just stick with this. It's a lie, because the reason why I think they're going around doing that, like I've said on numerous videos prior to this, they're making the gate. It's the two pillars. This is the Stargate. It's the same thing as the devil horns. It's just the two pillars. They're doing the tree of life. They're doing the Stargate. They're doing the gateway, the keyhole. That's what this stuff is. It's obviously not them walking around because it has anything to do with what happened, because the mainstream media came out and debunked it. So, well, that thing turns out it's a lie. So why they got people walking around doing it?
Right, so that was a lot at once. Because that's kind of how conspiracy theories go, is that like in American conspiracy theory culture, the tendency is like to make a giant sort of katamari ball of conspiracy theories and say like this relates to this, relates to this, relates to this. But like what this fellow is basically claiming is that the St. Louis Arch is a Stargate, like in the Kurt Russell film Stargate, that connects us to Saturn, which is a planet on which the fallen angels, I think, live. So basically, Satan is an alien, or aliens are Satan and fallen angels, and they are on Saturn, and Stargate connects us to Saturn. But the Stargate in St. Louis, Missouri, the St. Louis Arch, is broken, and they're trying to fix it. And so the way they're trying to fix it is apparently by using Black Lives Matter protesters in a ritual in which, when they put their arms up saying hands up, don't shoot, they are essentially recreating the sort of pillars of the St. Louis Arch as a way of directing occult energy toward it to make it work so they can talk to aliens. And I know, like, you're gonna say, I get it, like, Cooper, this is hypocrisy. You do a show about witchcraft and you're totally on board with that, but somehow aliens, you're skeptical of that? And really, honestly, I'd be much more willing to go along with this if you weren't basically suggesting that Black Lives Matter is some sort of weird ruse involving aliens instead of like an actual legitimate response to increasing levels of police violence and a lack of accountability among our authorities, especially in terms of their racist predilections. And yeah, maybe that's what's turning me off. But like, I don't know. I don't buy it. But he's got a bunch of YouTube videos, so if you want to like get deeper in this rabbit hole, like, hey, you can do that. I'm not going to link to any of them or anything, but like, you can go find them. You've got free time. You've got free will. Do what you want. Anyway, so yeah, hey, thank you for sending in that question about the St. Louis Arch. And if you have any other questions for our research department, please do send those to intothedarkrfb rfbfreak@gmail.com. That's R as in radio, F as in free, and B as in Brooklyn, because you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Or, you know, just get at me on Twitter like that person did. Go to @CooperWilhelm. Cooper as in the beginning of cooperation, and Wilhelm as in... it's the German version of William, so you, I don't mean... like, it's like you will helm a ship, but there's only one L. I don't know. It's Twitter, Google, find me. It's okay. So now we're going to move on to an interview I did that I frankly am looking forward to now, because I feel kind of weirdly shell-shocked by talking about the St. Louis Arch conspiracies. But I talked to Callum Hutchings, and Callum Hutchings is a lovely fellow who is researching the occult practices of Thailand. We got to talking about that, and... he had a lot of really exciting, interesting things to say. And he also recently wrote an article about one of the topics we actually talked about in the interview. So I will talk about that afterwards, and also like post a bunch of links to a bunch of cool resources he pointed me toward when this becomes a podcast. But in the meantime, here's Callum. Check him out.
This recorder seems to be going, so I think we should be all right. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go whenever you are, man.
Sick. Okay, cool. So thanks for agreeing to talk with me about all this. But right off the bat, when you got into occult topics, did you start with the occult practices of Thailand, or did you start somewhere else and kind of transition into that?
Well, to start with, I was kind of brought up pagan here in England, and that kind of, you know, spikes the interest. But it was kind of never for me. I've always been into Asian culture and whatnot, so... decided with some members of my family to go to Southeast Asia, and we ended up choosing Thailand. And that's kind of what basically kicked it off.
Okay. And have you found that, like, spiritual practices you found in Thailand, do they differ widely from the sort of pagan upbringing you had, or...?
It's kind of weird, because I thought there would be a huge, huge difference, but there really isn't. There is... of course, there's different languages and different icons, but it is very, very close to a lot of other occult practices I've read up about.
Okay, so what are some of the bigger sort of revelations you had when you started looking into this? Like, what are the sort of the surprises, either like in terms of just things that are very similar or things that are very different that you ran into?
Well. Through paganism, I've of course heard of runes and all the languages. And one of the first things I saw when in Thailand were inside a taxi on the roof, there was a kind of drawings, kind of like sacred geometry. Mm-hmm. And I found out it's called Yants, and basically it's almost exactly the same as runes. It's drawings and languages that can, I don't know, give protection, and it was just kind of, I don't know, when I first saw it, I was like, okay. What is this?
Yeah.
What is this? Why is this taxi covered in this drawing? And that was kind of the main connection I saw to start with. And the magic over there is based a lot on languages, which a lot of pagan witchcraft over here, chanting and stuff, it is as well. So having that connection kind of helped me kind of jump into the Thai cult a lot easier than just being... I don't know, a tourist, not knowing anything.
Right. So would you say that, like, a lot of what you found was spell-based, or was it sort of, like, pictographic or ritualistic, or...?
For a newcomer coming in, it is mainly kind of spells. It's only when you delve a bit deeper that you see the more ritualistic side. But the thing with Thailand is, unlike England and America, it's, what, 93% Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, it's mixed with animist magic, and it shows, it really does show. It's only just becoming westernized, and it's weird to see a country that's still having magic in the forefront of their culture.
So this isn't like a thing that's sort of tucked away or private. This is sort of out in the open a lot. I mean, you said it was in a taxi cab, right? So like, this is sort of everywhere in Thailand?
I'd almost say 90% of taxis you go in, they will have an amulet, they will have a yant drawn inside. The driver will even have, maybe, you can have a yant tattooed onto you, and that's called a sak yant. It means tattooed. Sack means tattooed. Hmm. And some of the drivers will have those on them. Because the roads are extremely dangerous in Thailand, like you'll have 8 motorbikes in a 2-lane, and it's ridiculous. They want protection. And you'll hear these like stories of, oh, a taxi cab crashes into a bridge, and the man survives clinging onto his amulet, and weird stuff like that. And it really is in the forefront. There is the darker side, which is a bit taboo to talk about openly.
Okay.
But there is a magic in the forefront, which I've not seen before.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very different from contemporary Western culture, definitely. When you say that there's this darker side that's taboo to talk about, taboo there, or would you be willing to go more into that? Because no pressure. I'm not here to like put you in an uncomfortable position, but like,
I'd say it's definitely more taboo in the Western eyes, and it is more taboo. It's growing more taboo over there now because of the Westernization, and this is mainly the necromantic kind of views on what some people do. And it does completely sound crazy to some people. Like, I've tried talking to my family about it. Like, why are you interested in this?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you've got to look at it as a viewpoint from people that have lived kind of a tribal life all the way till now. And they're very connected with spirituality, where we aren't that much anymore.
Yeah. When you say necromantic, do you mean necromantic in the sense of involving demons, or necromantic in the sense of involving raising the dead?
It's more raising the dead.
Okay.
That I've noticed. There is some kind of demon sense if you look into the Hinduist and Buddhist stuff that's mixed in, like Mara and all the other demons that tantalize Buddha. That's just Buddhism. But when you look into the animist kind of occult side, there's more necromantic stuff. And there's one thing called a Kumantong, which relates to Golden Child. And this is where people are kind of skeptic, because it's made using the body of a fetus that's stillborn within a woman.
Okay.
And this comes from a story of a great general called Kun Pyun. And he was a magician, or a wizard, or whatever you'd call it. And he was in a warring state of Thailand. There was a lot of wars back then. Iwa Teo under siege a lot. And he used magic a lot to succeed in so many battles. And one of the things he did was, there's many stories on how he did it and what happened, but I'll go with the most famous one, is that he basically cut his stillborn child out of his wife, roasted it over a fire while chanting, and I think he did this for 2 days straight.
Okay.
Making it become this entity called a Kumantong. And basically this baby is kind of like a guardian spirit, and because it died in the womb and because it's his son, it was the most powerful Kumantong in history. And this has kind of gone through history and became more taboo because, you know, burning babies.
Right.
But it's still going on.
So okay. And like, if somebody were to make one of these, is it more that they would make it for themselves, or is there some sense that you would go to someone to try to get one of these?
Well, through my knowledge of research on this particular amulet slash deity, there's people that have done it themselves, which is a bit, but I'll start off with the more Buddhist view on it. A lot of monks, what they'll do is, if a woman's baby died in her womb, they would take it out and they would turn it into an amulet, because by dying in the womb, your karma is terrible. And by turning the baby into a Kumantong, if you dedicate your merit, which is basically charity, good deeds, to this baby, its karma will go back up, and then it can reincarnate. So basically, it's not as dark as you'd think if you look at the Buddhist side. It is, they want to help this baby be able to reincarnate, because its karma is bad because it died.
Okay.
And by giving merit and charity to the baby, it'll help you, like, just little whispers in the ear I've heard. So say, you're driving on the road and a car's coming speeding behind you, you just get that little sense just to move so you don't crash. Little things like that you hear. And then there's crazier stories like saying people have died from spirits, from evil Kuomintangs and stuff. But the way I view it most popularly is the kind of good side. And it does get wrapped up in the bad of the dark side. But in its whole, through the most common, I guess, ideologies that I see, it is a good thing if you understand Thailand.
Yeah.
A Western view, it's just this guy's burning a baby, that's terrible.
Right.
But it is a good thing. They just want to help this baby live a new life.
Right.
But then there's the darker side, and I can't hide it because it does go on. There's been temples found with just stolen babies under the floorboards. And I don't mean temples like Buddhist temples. There's a longphor, which means basically monk.
Okay.
And there's an ajahn, which means teacher. And ajahn kind of strays a bit more to the black magic. So it'd be his kind of temple. And there was a famous man, when was this? He did go to jail, but he was released. But he's known as the baby burner because he burned babies alive and stole babies from body parts from abortion clinics, and he'd do kind of underground abortions to get these babies. And he's kind of one of the main people in the mainstream that's given this whole situation a bad name.
Right.
Because some of the stuff he did was evil, like apparently he's killed people and so on and so forth, adding just his bad situation up. So there is the dark side, and you can't hide that. So people like me do try and give the Buddhist story to kind of portray that in popularity, it's not a bad thing.
Right, right.
But there's always bad people.
Fair. And I mean, that's true in any sort of religion or spiritual practice or anything like that. So sometimes people will make amulets out of these golden children, but do they make amulets? I mean, so amulet culture seems to be very strong there, is the impression I'm getting. Like, there's a lot of use of amulets.
There was a Cascorn Research Center that estimated in, I think it was 2008, that the amulet market was worth about $1 billion.
Jeez.
Which is about 40 billion Thai baht. So the amulet situation, because it goes all the way back to, I don't know, 14th century. So some of these things are antiquities, and that's what does boost up the price.
Mm.
But it is very popular. Like, if you go to Thailand, you will see an amulet. No, you will. And it is hugely popular.
And most of these amulets, do they incorporate some sort of organic matter or some sort of, like, formerly living thing, like these sort of golden child amulets do? Or are they mostly just sort of, like, images on metal or characters on metal?
The more mainstream ones definitely have what is called, it's called pry. Pry means human material.
Okay.
And a lot of the mainstream ones won't have that in. But, so the mainstream ones can be made out of wood, resin, bronze, and just sacred herbs. Like, I've heard of amulets made with 108 different herbs condensed into this tiny amulet. But then again, there is the amulets that do contain prime material. And I'm sure you've heard of a yoni before. The female genital area is kind of a Hindu term. It's kind of a... A lot of men will wear a yoni to attract women.
Okay.
And this goes so dark, especially because the Thai amulet scene is huge in Singapore as well. You'll hear more of dark stuff from Singapore. And there's been amulets, yoni amulets, actually made out of a woman's cut-off vagina.
Jesus.
That's how crazy it can go. It can go from wood to vagina, and it's ridiculous.
From wood to vagina in under 60 seconds. That's horrifying. Okay. But the ones that do contain these human materials, is it always that dark? Because these sound more like a lot of these are coming out of, like, sort of harvesting something from a living human being, Like, are any of these sort of, like, part of, like, an ancestor worship sort of tradition? Or, like, finding people who are already dead and it's kind of fine? Or...
A lot of the amulets that I own that contain prime material aren't, like, bits of body cut off or anything. Okay. What they'll do is, the main thing they'll do is they'll get dirt from 7 cemeteries. Mm-hmm. I don't know why 7, it's just an auspicious number.
Okay.
And what will happen is, a lot of people who are under a lineage of Buddhist ancestry, if they get basically cremated, the ashes can then go into an amulet with the dirt. Sometimes coffin nails as well.
Okay.
I've seen coffin nails kind of a big thing as well lately. And that's kind of the more mainstream version of prime material, ashes, dirt, just pieces of coffin, not actually flesh.
So for those, is the, because like, I understand like with the sort of the golden child, the idea is like you're helping to sort of charge the child with positive energy, and with the sort of vaginal amulets, there's sort of a sympathetic magic going on there to some extent. But when you have something like grave dirt or coffin nails, what is sort of the rationale behind that? Is it just these are sort of powerful objects, or is there something more complex going on?
I guess they are powerful in a sense, but then there is also the adding of these spirits have lived a good life, you know, following the Buddhist path. And by them being this amulet, they're going to help you on your path. And this is when kind of the kind of chaos magic comes into play, where, you know, if you believe that these people led a Buddhist life and then you follow the Buddhist life, it's going to add to the kind of Buddhist magic. Like, belief is... It's hard to believe that, you know, pieces of flesh are going to give you magic powers, but right. Belief is very, very big, especially when taboo subjects are involved. Absolutely. So, a lot of people do believe that by having ashes and the graveyard dirt, there's guardians that protect the graveyard, so that adds to it. There's the ashes. It's kind of... Like, if you look at shamanistic techniques and you see ghosts helping people in meditative states, stuff like that, that can happen if you take cycle very seriously. If you just follow the Buddhist path, it's just a reminder of the Buddhist ways.
Mm. So there's
these,
like...
people have died a Buddhist to become an amulet and then are helping you. It's kind of a regenerative system in a way.
Okay. So would you say that while the sort of Thai cult practices and sort of Buddhist beliefs are in some ways distinct, you don't, it's not sort of like an either or thing, like one is not set in opposition to the other?
I've had this argument with many of my friends that are in the situation. A lot of people would say, oh, the Thai cult is not Buddhist, it's not this, it is, it's all one big thing.
Okay.
I'd say Buddhism is a core of it, and then animism is the other core, and that makes up the Thai cult system.
Okay.
So there is no either or, you know, against, but it is separated through, you know, westernization, personal belief, whatnot.
And when people are interested in sort of exploring this in Thailand, are they doing that through some kind of, are they initiated into some sort of smaller group, or is this just a thing you kind of grow up with, or is it an individual study kind of thing? Like, do you have a teacher in this sort of regard? Do you, like, are you an acolyte of someone's, or you're just sort of in it?
Well, I have one of my, not a close friend, but a friend at the moment called, he's an Ajahn now, he's a teacher, his name's Gara, and... Okay. He joined a lineage, he's from Singapore, but he joined a lineage in Thailand. There is groups, lineages, that can span 300 years, passed down, a lot of the time, not even through books, just through talking. So there is, yeah, there's lots of lineages throughout Thailand, different things differentiating them. And it's the same with any religion, really, how you just have different groups under an umbrella. But anyone can really join a lineage, or you can be born in one. There'll be some lineages that won't invite anyone or won't have anyone because it's just family-based, just blood-based. But then there's places that will take anyone. I know there's a person from England, John Spencer Littlewood, who's a teacher over there now, doing tattooing, Sakyan tattooing, and other occult practices. So yeah, there is definitely groups.
Okay, and how widely used are things like grimoires over there? Because I know I've seen you have at least one sort of. Is it a grimoire or is it not? There's a book I saw you post about where you had there was an amulet worked into the binding.
It's, I wouldn't classify that as a grimoire. Okay. It's a book by someone called Peter Jenks in England, and he's not part of a lineage, but he's very popular at the moment over there for talking to a John. It's kind of being the Western voice at the moment.
Okay.
And he's helping a John's document their occult practices. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff they've got to keep secret, but a lot of grimoires got destroyed through battles of Ayutthaya and just Burma attacked Thailand a lot in the history. So a lot of things were destroyed, so they kind of kept to just speaking about it. But then I've seen pictures still of quite old, 100 years old books on tattooing, just pictures of tattoos with tiny amounts of detail. So there is a written guide to some of this stuff, but to find it is extremely hard because lineages will just hide it because they don't trust people anymore since, you know, their ancestors having all their stuff burned.
Right. Okay, so if someone wanted to explore this more, where would be a good place for them to turn then? Would they have to basically try to find one of these lineages, or is there a lot of information online? Is it just like you have to go to Thailand really and really sort of get in?
Well, what means some of the other people doing, like Peter Jenks, is a John Mehta as well, who's Australian. He's a tattoo Sakyan, and a John Spencer Littlewood. We are trying to get it more online because it is, you know, a lot of people who are interested in this thing can't spend a lot of money just to fly over to Thailand.
Right.
And then a lot of the lineages, like, even though we live in a world of social media, you're not going to be able to contact a magician on Facebook. I mean, there are some people that have reached out to social media. Like, I've got some monks and magicians on my friends list, but for them to be open is kind of hard, and which we are trying to get that foot in the door currently online, as well as in books, to help people learn more.
Okay, that's fantastic. Is there some, so are there any URLs or websites that you think would be, that are like sort of operational right now that would be good for people to go to? And I can also like post links to that too for people if you send them to me later, if anything like comes to mind later on.
The first one I discovered is the Amulet Forum. It's just the Amulet Forum. And a lot of Singapore people, Chinese people, English people, even some French people, American people are on there now. And that kind of talks about more the mainstream amulets. And that's a good, it is a good big forum with a lot of information. And then there's the ThaiOccult.com, which is owned by Peter Jenks. He's the person who did the book that I was showing off online. Mm-hmm. He's got two books now. And then there's Buddhist Magic, I think it's called as well, by John Spencer Littlewood. He does e-magazines every now and again with just little bits talking about the ThaiOccult. And those are kind of the three main websites that I've used in the past for learning things, looking at things. Yeah.
Okay, great. And I'll post links to that for everybody. Great. Okay, so we've talked about it. So, these tattoos, so you were saying that a lot of, like, you'll see a lot of people with, like, say, one image or one symbol tattooed on themselves for protection, it seems like, most of the time. Are there other sort of wider uses for these sort of occult tattoos? Like, if you were to run into, say, like one of these magicians on the street, would they just be covered in these tattoos?
I have seen people with complete bodysuits of these tattoos, and they can range from just luck, love, money, protection. Some lineages that have came from Burma and Cambodia can have crazy magic, like saying you can go invisible and stuff like that. But yeah, you will see, you can see people completely covered. I mean, just typing Sakyant on the internet, you will just see Thai men. A lot of Muay Thai fighters use them as well for protection. You know, the Muay Thai fighting over there, and you can see them absolutely covered in these tattoos. And a lot of the time, it's not just writing; there is images as well. They use a lot of animal images, which come from the animistic side. So say if you have the image of a tiger, it's going to bestow properties of the tiger to you. So a lot of fighters will use that, you know, be ferocious, courage, whatnot. I've even seen crazy things. There's one funny one I've seen of a woman having sex with a horse, and what this is meant to represent is this magic is so powerful that any woman you influence would have sex with a horse for you.
That sorry, this feels like the Boys to Men song that never quite got written. That's wow, that's fantastic. Okay, and so, and these are like, these are just to like underscore this. This is all very common. This is all very sort of everyday. Like anyone you run into in the street might have one of these tattoos at some point.
Yeah, and it's even before, a lot of women weren't allowed them, but a lot of the Ajahns have opened up for women to have them. So there's, I think it was Angelina Jolie got quite famous with an Ajahn a few years back. I think it was Angelina Jolie. Mm-hmm. And she got what's called a five-line yant on her back. And ever since she did that, Western people have just been going over there. So about a month ago, I saw someone in England, a white guy, who had almost the same five lines on his arm. So it is common, and then isn't as well.
Okay.
Because a lot of people cover up in Thailand because of business. It is a big business country. But they will have them. You just won't be able to see them a lot of the time. But people will have them.
Okay. In terms of ritual practice, is there like a lot of sort of regular sort of like, is there like a sort of ritualistic calendar at play in any of this? Or is it more just sort of when you need to do a thing for a thing, you do the thing? If that makes sense.
There's both. There is calendar rituals where they'll base it on the things the Buddha did. Okay. So his birthday, his death, when he enlightened. So there's the Buddhist calendar. Then there's a Thai calendar. Some people also use the Chinese calendar. So there is a lot of sacred days, like sometimes you'll only worship one deity on a Thursday. But then there is everyday stuff, like I chant in the morning to my altar every morning, and some people I know do this three times a day. So there is everyday practices and there is specific day practices.
What kind of objects would one find on a Thai altar typically? Like, is it more or less sort of like a Western altar in a lot of ways, or is there a lot of difference in terms of what might actually appear on someone's private altar?
It is a similar setup to Western altars.
Okay.
The main difference is that having the Asian figures. So the main thing is having, in the centerpiece, is an image of Buddha. And then you'll have your offerings, which like they're mainly Thai things, so limes, betel nuts, jasmine flowers, water. Then you'll have your amulets kind of in the center, you know, because you kind of give a home to your amulets, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Western similarities to the altar. Like, you can see on some pagan altars, they'll have knives and stuff. There is ritualistic knives we have in the Thai cult system as well. Some of them have came from Tibetan knives. Like, I have one on my arm, a tattooed, a ferba, which is a ritualistic knife for meditation. And then there's just normal knives as well. But there's candles. Candles is a huge thing I've noticed coming back in Thai cult system. it kind of stopped a little bit in the mainstream.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of came back, like, using candles as well as incense and joss sticks.
Okay.
So say you're praying in the morning to your amulets and to Buddha, like, you need good business today, you'll burn a green candle.
Mm.
You need good love today, you want to find a romance today, a red candle.
Yeah.
And that's came back, and that kind of relates to a Western altar as well.
Definitely. Wow, okay, that's... Huh. Okay, and so you've been exploring this for some time. Do you have any sort of, like, goals in mind for what you want to be doing with this? Like, are you sort of hoping to join one of these lineages, or is this just sort of a passion and an interest, but and something to, like, incorporate into your larger spiritual practice, but not necessarily... I guess what I'm saying is, are you going sort of, like, all the way with this, or is this just a thing that you're sort of... Because clearly you are incredibly knowledgeable about this. But is this, like, a hobby, or is this, like, a big part of your own practice?
It is a big part, and it is something I do want to strive to delve into. I'm still looking at ways to move over to Thailand and situations like that. I want to, hopefully one day, be robed as a monk for a short period of time to get more views on a temple living life. And then I do want, because I've got quite a few friends over there now, and I do want to speak to some of the teachers and hopefully one day be part of a lineage, even if I have to fly from Thailand to England a lot, I'll do it, because since I've worked in antiques in before, I believe in history is such an important thing.
Mm.
And witnessing this system, it needs to be out there more. Like, if this died out, which I don't think would happen, but it's still a worry.
Yeah.
I want to be part of keeping that alive, definitely. So it is a big part of what I want to do in life, definitely.
Fantastic. Okay, so I think we're coming sort of near the end of our time a little bit. So since you have this forum now to talk to literally tens of listeners, is there anything you'd want to tell people now, like, just in an open-ended sort of way? Like, is there anything you'd want to say to these people who are interested in magic and the occult and so on?
Well, main things I can say: visit the links I've said, kind of gain some basic knowledge, and if it grasps you, go to Thailand, because you will not regret it. You, as soon as setting foot in that country, you feel magic, and it is such a, is, I would say, life-changing situation, a lot of the things you witness over there. So if you want to delve into the occult and understand more things, read up about it online, gain a basic understanding, and if you can, visit Thailand, definitely.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with me. I really enjoyed this a lot.
Thank you for having me on, Cooper.
So, big thanks to Callum for talking to me about all these interesting topics, and you can find him on Facebook, and I will put up links to all of the websites he talked about when this becomes a podcast, and I'll also put up a link to an article he just put out about this practice of making amulets out of stillborn or aborted human babies, because it is a good article and it is a fascinating topic, and you should read it, I would say. I think it's, like, talking to him about that, and especially about, like, that idea of, like, occult tattoos and magic tattoos. I got to thinking about that a lot, and, like, you know, the thing is, like, this practice is in no way confined to Thailand or East Asia, and its roots go back into ancient history. For example, Uzi, the Iceman, who is found on the Austrian-Italian border of the Alps, and is probably from around 3,300 BCE, had these tattoos on his ankle, knee, and spine over what was appeared to be tissue that had degenerated through strain, and it's been suggested that those might have been tattoos that were intended to cure arthritis through magic. And you also have figures like, for example, an Egyptian woman from about 700 AD, who's likely a Christian, was found with the name of the Archangel Michael tattooed on her inner thigh. And it was thought that, like, early Christians would get tattoos of divine names in their bodies as protection, and that especially pregnant women would get the tattoos of the names of, say, like, angels on their abdomens to ensure a smooth birth. But, like, this idea of magic tattoos goes across a number of different cultures. For example, there are fertility tattoos you'd find among the Chukchi, who would also often will get tattoos of anthropomorphic figures. The warriors of the Chukchi tribe would get tattoos of human figures on their shoulders, representing the people they had killed in battle, in the hopes that the tattoo would trap their souls and convert them into essentially helpers. And you would also find the idea of, like, tattoos to trap souls among the Mentawai people of Indonesia, who have been known to have tattoos designed to sort of bind their own souls into their bodies and to keep them intact in that way. But at the same time, like, you also, like, this practice, like, it feels like a sort of thing that, like, it continues throughout human history. So, like, you have warriors in Borneo. There was a fellow in Borneo who claimed that his spiritual protector, his protective spirit, led him into the jungle to where a meteorite had landed. And he started taking that meteorite and putting it in every vial of tattoo ink he used to give himself and other people tattoos. And this was during World War II. And it's said that with these protective meteorite tattoos, these warriors who were in many ways outmatched by the invading Japanese forces, because the Japanese would have heavy machine guns and the like, and these warriors were working with much more traditional weapons, spears, blow darts, etc. They were incredibly successful, and only one out of the 50-some-odd warriors of this group died during battle. And this tattoo artist was quoted as saying that bullets would go around him, or they would go through him, but they would never injure him because of this tattoo. And in fact, there was a story floating around in December of last year, I think in Thailand, that a group of graveyard workers had exhumed a body because they were moving it from a graveyard that was, I think, something like 200 years old. And the skin under one particular tattoo of an occult nature had been preserved perfectly. And it was thought that what had happened was that this person had died of appendicitis because they were unable to cut through the skin of the tattoo. It was too strong, the protective powers of it. And just to sort of bring this all full circle, there's also the Lajunaga people of India, who apparently, there's some who among that group who believe that without a certain set of occult or spiritual tattoos, their ancestors will be unable to recognize them in the afterlife. Though actually, to bring this even back to the top of the episode, so if you were listening very closely during the first few moments of this episode, you might have noticed that I was playing a clip from the 2005, because, yeah, just to make this a little less serious, there was a 2005 Keanu Reeves movie called Constantine, based on the Hellblazer comic book series. And near the end of that film, Keanu Reeves' character brings together his forearms, on which are tattooed two halves of an occult image that he uses to make the angel Gabriel manifest. And I was looking into it, and I was like, what? Because, like, I remembered, when I started thinking about this, I was remembering that movie because I just liked it a lot when I was younger. And I thought, what symbol is that? And so I found it, and it's like this, it's the alchemical symbol for red sulfur, or red, the perfect king, red sulfur. And the idea is, like, that this substance, red sulfur, is supposed to be the joining, in a more allegorical sense, of basically the soul, represented by sulfur, and the spirit, represented by mercury, which are sort of gendered as being male and female, respectively, within alchemy. And the idea is you're trying to join these things together, which is interesting, because, like, I hadn't really thought about, like, what that symbol would, what that would be related to that, but it's strange, because that's also, like, an idea that's very near and dear to my own heart in the very stupid, obvious, literal way that I have a tattoo from the alchemical manuscript, The Rosary of the Philosophers, from 1550, about the process of trying to join those two things together, and that tattoo is on the left side of my chest, so actually directly over the heart that I use to pump blood through my stupid body. Anyway, so thank you so much for listening to the episode. We're running up on the end of the show, and I wanted to just quickly say, hey, if you want to support Radio for Brooklyn, go to radioforbrooklyn.com/pledge. Check this out when it becomes a podcast for all those links. And also, if you're in the Brooklyn area, I'm going to be giving a talk on necromancy and necromantic techniques, so techniques for raising the dead, at the end of the month at Catlan Books. The exact date is not yet set, so good way to know about that is either like check their website at catlandbooks.com or check my Twitter feed, which is also a good way to get out to reach out to me if you want to submit a question to our research department, like that one we talked about earlier involving the St. Louis Arch. And that Twitter again is at Cooper Wilhelm. And you can, you know, if you're in Brooklyn, come by, listen to me talk about how necromancy is, honestly, if you look at like a lot of the old techniques, necromancy is difficult, it is unpleasant, and it is just not fun, honestly. But like, it's cool to think about, but like, to actually do, not the best. I mean, you know, it's very easy to get wrong, and then you've wasted a lot of effort, and also it's like less fun than you might think. Also, time sensitive, now that I think about it, because I actually wrote this down and I almost forgot to say. This fellow Jenks, who is one of the sort of sources for information on the Thai occult, he's got a book on these occult tattoos in Thailand called his Thai Occult Sak Yent Book. And the thing is, apparently there's been a copyright issue with something to do with the back of the book. So this book is actually only going to be available up through July 23rd. And I looked at it and I was thinking like, oh, should I get a copy of this? And it's like, it's 75 euros. So that's, I don't know, that's like more dollars than 75. I hadn't actually looked at the conversion or anything like that. But like, if this is something that interests you, that seems like a good resource to get. But if you want to get it, you need to get it before July 23rd. Because apparently that's going to stop being available. So, yeah. Thanks for listening. Have yourself a great night. And check us out next. So, 2 weeks from now, we're also going to be doing a show where I'm pretty sure I'm going to be talking to, if everything works out, because I'm trying to work out the dates for this interview, but I'm probably be talking to Annie Finch. And Annie Finch is a poet and witch from the state of Maine. So we're going to be able to talk about, I'm hoping we're going to be able to talk about the relationship between poetry and witchcraft, because these things are interrelated, not just because you have a lot of like, especially like traditions of rhyming spells, especially among, in the British Isles, there was a tendency for sort of rhyming spellcraft, but also just this idea that music and musical language has always been sort of vaguely associated with spellcraft. For example, I've been reading a book of essays by the Russian theorist Mikhail Bakhtin, mostly about the carnivalesque and the grotesque in literature, and the idea that sort of medieval humor is infinitely different from modern concepts of satire because of various things. But one of the points he makes, sorry, I got sidetracked by the theory, but one of the interesting points that he makes is that there's some understanding that very elaborate insults, long, complicated, floral insults, were somehow related to incantation. There was sort of a sense that this language that in some ways is sort of very separate from like our day-to-day life, but also is very close to it because it involves insult or involves humor in the way that poetry often can, is rooted in magic. Anyway, so keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Have yourself a good day. We'll see you in 2 weeks on Into the Dark.